It's time for Money Matters with Doug and Linda Lewis. Doug is a certified financial planner, providing you with a personal financial hotline to answer your questions about tax planning, investments, retirement planning, estate planning, and education planning. Doug and Linda are the owners of Lewis Financial Management, a registered investment advisory firm in Raleigh, providing financial and investment services since 1983. Doug and Linda will be answering your questions on WPTF's phone lines anytime during the next hour. Call 860-9783. That's 860-WPTF. Call toll-free 1-800-662-7979. And for mobile phones, it's star 680. And now, Doug and Linda Lewis and Money Matters.
Hello there, North Carolina. This is Doug Lewis, Certified Financial Planner, once again welcoming you to Money Matters with Doug and Linda Lewis. Money Matters with Doug and Linda has been providing you with a personal financial hotline for all of your questions about investments, estate planning, tax planning, money management, and retirement planning for over 20 years. And again, with me as usual tonight is my wife, Linda, who works with me in our firm, Lewis Financial Management.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the show. Doug and I are the owners of Lewis Financial Management, a registered investment advisory firm in Raleigh, providing investment and financial advice since 1983.
For over 20 years,
we've been answering your questions on the WPTF phone lines. They are your questions and our answers.
So sit back and enjoy, or if you're free, call us tonight on the open lines. We'll take your calls anytime during the next hour. You're free to call in and ask any financial question about your own personal financial planning. Call us at 860-9783. That's 860-WPTF. Or you can call us toll-free long distance at 1-800-662-7979.
Well, financial planning is everyone's business, and still for most folks, money matters are just a big puzzle. Folks have questions about planning for retirement, planning for a child's college education. They don't know the difference between financial planning and money management. They want to know a lot these days. They want to know what's a mutual fund, what's a limited partnership, what's a REIT, what's a will? What's a living will? And yes, it really can confuse you, but you're not alone. Because in a world crowded with new investments, changing tax laws, rapidly evolving insurance products, and volatile economic cycles, more and more people are looking for clear direction in their financial lives. And yet, unfortunately, the busier and the more successful they are, the less time they have to sort out their financial affairs. And people are asking, is there any solution?
Well, yes, Doug, there certainly is a solution. Out of this increasingly complicated financial environment has come a new breed of professionals that are trying to solve people's money puzzles. And that's the Certified Financial Planner.
It's the Certified Financial Planner who offers something that people don't get from the traditional stockbroker, money manager, accountant, insurance agent, or bank trust officer. And that's a way to consolidate all aspects of people's financial affairs into one financial plan. It's the Certified Financial Planner who knows how to pull together all six areas of a client's financial life.
Doug, I think for many people, the first area of financial planning is cash flow planning, with questions about their emergency fund, their mortgage, their credit cards, and reducing their debt.
Well, yes, Linda, and yet for many people, the second area of financial planning is retirement planning. Those who are working want to know how to compute what they'll need to live on during retirement and how much they should be saving for retirement. They want to know what investments they should choose from the choices in their company's 401k plan. Others are retiring and have received a lump sum payout option from their company's retirement plan, and they want to know, should they take it? And if so, how should they invest it?
Well, Doug, the third area of financial planning that must be dealt with is estate planning. For most people, over their working years, their estate has grown. How can they reduce their estate taxes? And they wonder, are their simple wills sufficient, or maybe they should be considering the complicated world of trusts?
If that's the third area, Linda, the fourth area of financial planning cannot be overlooked. This is tax planning. People are interested in both tax reduction strategies and tax reduction investments, home mortgage interest, charitable giving, tax shelters, tax-free bonds, questions about capital gains taxes, estate taxes, gift taxes, and how to sell real estate tax-free using trusts. What a confusion.
Well, Doug, we can't forget the fifth area of financial planning, which is insurance planning. How much life insurance does a family really need? Do they have too little insurance or maybe too much insurance? Should they have whole life, term, or universal? Should they have long-term nursing care coverage?
You're right, Lynn. And of course, the sixth and most important area of financial planning is investment planning. Here, the questions never stop. What's the best way to diversify my investments? Is now a safe time to invest in stocks? What about bonds? What kind of stock mutual funds? Bond mutual funds, equipment leasing partnerships, REITs, CDs, gold, annuities.
So, Doug, it seems that at last it's time for people to understand that a certified financial planner is really the only one who can tie together all six parts of their financial puzzle. And to you out there listening, if you've got a question on your mind about cash flow planning, retirement planning, estate planning, tax planning, insurance, or investments, call us now on the open lines and we'll answer your financial planning questions. Those numbers to call are 860-9783. That's 860-WPTF. Out of towners, call us toll free at 1-800-662-7979. And if you just want to sit back and listen to the callers through the years, welcome to the show.
Investment advice through Lewis Financial Management, investments through HBEC Inc. Lewis Financial Management and HBEC Inc. are not related. Well, good evening, Linda. We're here again, another night, a beautiful evening, leaves are turning, and we're all here again on the air tonight, and not only you, but also Deborah. Deborah, how are you this evening?
I'm doing well. I noticed the leaves changing as we were driving in also. I think we're probably 2-3 weeks away from peak weekend.
I think you may be right. Yeah.
Well, what are we going to be talking about tonight? A lot has hit the news.
It is like almost investing in a black swan world. I mean, there are constant huge changes happening on every front. I guess the news has been under your nose all week.
It really has. And there have been a lot of articles primarily about what's been going on with the mortgage rates and how they just seem to be going down and what people can do with that knowledge. What you know, they're asking a lot of questions. What do I do? Do I refinance? Is it worth it?
Well, you know, the mortgage industry, of course, is tied to the homes. Residential real estate, very much so. And there was a big article this past week that said the home forecast calls for more pain, P-A-I-N. A lot of pain coming. Economists and builders and mortgage analysts are all predicting that the weakened U.S. economy is going to depress housing prices for years, restraining consumer spending, pushing more homeowners into foreclosure, clouding prospects for a sustained recovery, and home prices are expected to drop 2.5% this year. So on the home front itself, there is nothing good except a lot of pain coming. But, of course, that does tie to the other side of the picture, and that's mortgage interest rates.
So while you, if you're trying to sell, it's probably not a good time and you might be feeling that pain. But if you are financially okay and you are positioned to where you could refinance, it's probably an opportune time.
It's an incredibly opportune time. We are seeing the mortgage rate drops drastically. We've seen 30-year fixed rate mortgages are now below 4%.
I can't even, within my lifetime, and I'm in my 40s, I don't think it's been here.
No. As a matter of fact, we haven't seen rates like this. I never remember them. Maybe in the 50s we had rates, and I'm not sure we did then. No, the rate drop has been spurring a lot of home refinancing, and there was indeed a big article. I forget which paper it was in. It might have been the Journal this past week, but on the new refinancings, and they even had some numbers there. What would happen with a $400,000 loan under different mortgage interest rates? Did you see that?
I did. And I guess the biggest question would be to someone, if you were interested in refinancing and doing it and knowing that you're going to be incurring a cost, it's got to be worth it, because you're going to do something for your own finances with that excess income.
Yeah, the figures were almost tantalizing. The article had a $400,000 loan with a fixed rate and somebody who right now might still have a 6% mortgage, and his payments were $2,398 a month. Or maybe he refinanced last year and he got it down to 5%, and his payments are $2,147 a month. But under a present 3.5% loan, the payments would drop from $2,347 to $1,796. That's about a, my gosh, I think it's about a $500 a month drop. And so that is what's spurring all these refinancings. But there's a sort of a double-edged sword that we have to watch out for there.
What's that?
Well, a lot of people just say, gee, I can lower my mortgage payments. That's wonderful. I can save $500 a month. Let's refinance. If the goal in lowering your mortgage payments is to refinance and have more spendable income, then that's the wrong reason. If all you're going to do is refinance, drop your payments $500 a month, and now have $500 a month more to spend, then that is wrong because you have to pay closing costs. On the other hand, if you think it through and you say, let's refinance, let's bring our payments down $500 a month, and that's an extra $500 a month we can add into our investment portfolio using what we call a pay-yourself-first plan, now we can accumulate that savings. And if your investments have been doing anything more than 3.5%, that is a wonderful way to go because you're refinancing by saving $500 a month. You're also getting an interest deduction, which you haven't lost. It might wash out to be close to the same. But by the same token, you are accumulating now. And that's the right way to take advantage of this this situation we're in.
So someone can begin in the first part of the scenario, paying $2,398 a month for a mortgage payment, and if they refinance, now they'd be spending that same $2,398 a month, but only $1,796 of it going to the mortgage payment.
That's right.
And the excess money now going to their own investment portfolio.
That's exactly right.
So if you
right.
kept the same outflow, but you have it going in two different directions, you've now really made it worthwhile for those closing costs and the effort.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you can play that out on paper and see this is a smart move. The wrong move, the dumb move, is I got an extra $500-$600 a month to spend because you forget that it cost you. You might have wrapped it into your loan, but right. it's costing you.
Right, right. Wow. Well, that's probably very helpful for people who are thinking whether or not it's worth it to refinance.
Yeah, it was. It's big news on the home front and on the mortgage front. There's no doubt about that.
Well, there was a small little article in the paper, and I think it was a week ago, but it was about muni bonds. And I didn't really pull much from it, but it said that muni bonds seem to be poised for pain.
That was another pain article, and that one is very serious because that refers to bonds on municipal bonds issued by municipalities. And most people think that municipal bonds, tax-free bonds from municipalities, are a nice, safe investment. And yes, indeed, they have been one of the best performing classes of investments in 2011. But that rally might not last a lot longer because I think there is bad news coming on the municipal bond scene. And personally, I would not have any of our clients invested in municipal bond mutual funds. I think that was an alert and have to be careful not to be lured.
If you have any questions, do feel free to give us a call at 800-662-7979 or 860-9783. Or check us out on the web at LFMAdvisor.com.
Robert, Doug Lewis, how can I help you with your money matter this evening?
What are the advantages and disadvantages of joint ownership of securities or CDs or what have you between a parent and a child?
Well, I'd rather not make a blanket statement because each person's situation will differ. Let me know a little bit about your situation, Robert. How old are you?
60.
You're 60 years old.
Right.
What are the size of your estate?
In excess of $500,000.
Are you married?
Yes.
At your death, what do you want to happen to your estate?
To both children as well as the spouse.
Well, you got to choose now. I mean, as well as the spouse, who gets it first?
Well, the spouse would, of course.
Well, then you don't want joint ownership with a child because you've just disinherited your wife. The disadvantage of having joint ownership with a child is your wife doesn't get it. Joint ownership with rights of survivorship is the other owner owns it when the first owner dies. What is it that you're trying to achieve, Robert?
To make it possible for the children to have some ready money without having to go through the problems of probate and estate taxes and such, and not cutting the spouse out.
All right, let me make a suggestion.
Right.
What do you have in the way of liquid assets?
70, 80.
Including mutual funds?
No, that would up at another 150.
About another 150,000 or including that?
No, that would up at that, plus real estate and such.
All right. Now, when you die, what's your wife going to live on? Just the income from that, or she?
Well, she'd have the income from perhaps roughly $600,000 plus real estate plus her own retirement programs.
All right. What you probably would like to do is consider the features and benefits of a revocable living trust.
Mm-hmm.
In addition to that, to build in what's called credit shelter trusts into your estate plan. For example, the revocable living trust will avoid all probate, so that will achieve that benefit. The revocable living trust, however, will do nothing for tax relief. Now, if you've only got a $500,000, that's your combined estate, yours and your wife's?
No, it would probably double that. That's just mine.
All right. If your combined estate is $1 million,
right,
then you want to have what's called credit shelter trusts built into your estate plan. This allows you to leave the $500,000 into a trust, the income from which would go to your wife, but the principal at your wife's death would go to your children. This now allows you to pass that $500,000 tax-free to your children, but after your wife's death.
I see.
Your wife in her estate plan would set up the identical structure because we do not know who is going to die first.
Correct.
She also leaves her $500,000 not to you, but to a credit shelter trust. The income from that trust goes to you, but at your death, the principal goes to the children.
Now, is there an administrator of that trust?
You mean the trustee, I believe.
Correct.
Yes, I always recommend that you be the trustee of your wife's trust.
And she be the trustee of mine.
Right.
Uh-huh.
Now, you want to build into those credit shelter trusts provisions that if you or she, whoever is the surviving one, needs to access the principal, it can be accessed to maintain your normal lifestyle. But to protect yourself from an IRS attack, you make a co-trustee, namely one of your children, to be co-trustee that has only one power, and that is to make that decision to access principal to give to you. Any other decision is made by you. All the investment decisions are made by you. So in your case, you set up a credit shelter trust. Your wife is going to have the income from that credit shelter trust. Your wife is going to be the trustee of that credit shelter trust. Your wife is going to have all control of the assets, and she will also be the income beneficiary of that trust. So she will be investing the money for herself and paying herself an income stream, but the principal will go to the kids. Now, those two trusts I just told you are after your death, but they will not avoid probate. The way to avoid probate is during your lifetime, you set up a revocable living trust.
These two are not mutually exclusive.
No, one is a testamentary trust that begins its existence at your death, and the other is a living trust that you set up tomorrow.
But they should be done at the same time in terms of setting them up?
Well, yes. Here's the way that you should do it. You set up revocable living trust for yourself, and you transfer all of your assets into it right now today, and you are the trustee of your own trust.
Mm-hmm.
And since it's revocable, you've really done nothing. And the IRS also agrees you've done nothing.
Mm-hmm.
But what you have done is you have bypassed the probate process at death. In the revocable living trust at your death, it is written in your trust document that the assets in your trust will pass into this credit shelter trust. You see what I'm saying?
Yes, right.
You do the same thing for your wife, and now you have bypassed probate, so it happens instantaneously at your death, and you've also avoided estate taxes by the second set of trusts.
I see.
You see what happens there?
Right. But this would take a rather accurate inventory of all assets in order to set up the trust initially, correct?
Well, it's a no-brainer. You call me at the office and I'll show you. I do those all the time.
Oh, all right.
Yeah, I mean, that's a no-brainer. That's as easy as a piece of cake.
Well, that sounds good. Been most helpful, and I appreciate your time, sir.
Sounds like a dream, huh, Robert?
Sounds great.
Call us at the office.
We'll do it.
At 872-7000.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening.
Bye.
Thank you, Robert. You know, Lynn, I forgot to mention something that I wanted to talk about with regard to Robert's call, and it's the question of the advantage and disadvantages of joint ownership between husband and wife. That's the one that really throws people. Almost always, never own anything jointly.
Why not?
Because of something called the step-up in basis tax rules. The step-up in basis rules affect the asset value and the capital gains tax on the person who sells the inherited asset, because they only get half of the asset inherited because they already owned half. So if they've got something that they paid a small amount of dollars for and it's grown to be a large value, if you inherit it, as you know, you get the full step up in basis and you can sell it tax-free, capital gains tax-free, after you inherit it, right?
Right.
But if you own it jointly, then you already owned one half, and the person who dies with you, who owned the other half, then you only got the step up in basis in the half they owned.
Oh.
So you pay capital gains tax on that.
Well, Doug, that's obviously a call from our archives, but can you explain the new $5 million spousal portability rules? And does that do away with the unlimited exemption between spouses?
Actually, it doesn't, Deborah. The rule has always been that there is an unlimited marital deduction, meaning at death you can leave everything 100% tax-free to a spouse. That's an unlimited deduction which will wipe out your estate when you die, so there's no tax because you'd get a deduction and you leave it all to your wife or to your husband. That has not changed. What has changed is the exemption or the credit. Now that credit, which I referenced in the archive call, that credit is now up to $5 million, or it's a credit that will wipe out taxes on the first $5 million estate. So that credit was changed by a law called portability in the 2010 Tax Act, and that was really nice because now there is still an unlimited marital deduction that goes back to 1981, but transferring an unlimited amount of assets between spouses allows you to also, at death, transfer the credit that covers $5 million of the estate, which means if I have a $5 million credit and my wife, if Linda, you have a $5 million credit, and if I take the unlimited deduction and just say, I love my wife, I leave you everything, then if you have $10 million, then that means if we do it right, you can also, at death, pass $10 million tax-free, not $5 million. Couldn't do that before. That's why we did the credit shelter trust, because you couldn't move that credit from one person to the other. But now you can, and that is the spousal portability provision of the 2010 Act. For example, a couple that has a combined estate valued at $10 million and leaves everything to the surviving spouse. So there's no estate tax due. That's because of the unlimited marital deduction at the first death. But under those old rules, when the surviving spouse dies, the property in the estate above the estate tax exemption amount, $5 million, was subject to estate taxes. Well, assuming a $5 million exemption and no change in value of the estate, then $5 million would be subject to estate taxes and $5 million would pass tax-free. But with these new portability rules, the surviving spouse can use the deceased's spouse unused $5 million exemption. And so if you do it right, she'd have a $10 million exemption that she can use at her death. And that is beautiful, but you have to be careful because you have to file a federal estate tax return and a special form at the death of the first spouse to be able to have the portability of the unused credit from the first spouse to die to the second. If you do it right, you can pass $10 million tax-free, and those are the portability rules. It's a wonderful gift, but you better make sure that you're doing it right in your documents, because that's the role of the certified financial planner, to do the whole thing right for you.
And that's really, I think, where it always comes back to, is if you want to be able to speak from the grave, have your wishes executed the way you'd want it, if you want to take the time to do this planning, you better do it while you have a chance and put it in writing.
That's right. You can't do much planning after you're gone.
No, you really can't. Well, there was another article that was that caught my eye during the week, and it was titled Family Feuds, the Battle Over Retirement Accounts. And this comes up frequently.
Yes.
As much planning as you might want to do in one's life, there are remarriages, there are unexpected deaths. So in those type of situations, when a spouse does have instructions, and let's say it's typically where the wife is given instructions, the husband is saying, if something should happen to me, here's what I'd like. And then something does happen to him or to her first, and he's then remarrying. This is definitely a common situation.
It's very common because of the marriages that are breaking up and going through divorces and so forth. And it's very important to know who's in line to get your account, or maybe even the account of a parent or a spouse, at death when it's a retirement account. And you could be easily surprised. You know, that article, that caught my eye very much. And what it referenced was how families can be blindsided by another aspect of retirement accounts, and that's the confusing rules of who's entitled to assets of one spouse when somebody dies. Because you'd think it'd be real simple. Just whoever's the beneficiary. That's not the case. They had a case of a person named Leonard Kidder in the article. I don't know if you saw that that case, that Leonard Kidder case.
I did. And in this one, he was married, and his wife, just like I mentioned, died first. And so Leonard updated his account paperwork, naming his three adult children as the beneficiaries of the 401k.
He'd worked for this company, Cajun Industries, in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, for 20 years. And, of course, his wife, who he'd been married to for 41 years, was the beneficiary of this 401k that he had.
Right.
But then he, in thinking instead, he died before she died.
Well, no, she died before he did.
Yeah, he had said if he died before her.
Right.
But what went wrong was she died first. So then what did he do? He did what anybody would do. He went and changed the beneficiary on his 401k.
Oh, right. Yes, to his three adult children.
That's right. Because his wife had died. He didn't have a wife.
Now
so he changed it
children.
To his children as the heirs. And you would think that that took care of everything. But then what happened?
He meets and another woman and remarries.
That's right. He met that woman, Beth Kidder, and 6 weeks after he meets her and they get married, at the age of 66, he dies.
Oh,
no. Yeah. So now his kids from his first marriage,
they've been named the beneficiaries.
They're the beneficiaries. They're going to go claim his 401k plan. And lo and behold, the employer, Cajun Industries, said, no, we want the court to decide who's the rightful owner. You'd say, well, how could the court decide? It says the beneficiary is the kids. But under the terms of a company's 401k plan, if an employee dies, the spouse has the right to the entire account. What spouse? Not the dead one.
Right.
The second one.
Right.
The one that he married 6 weeks before he died.
And that's regardless of him having changed the beneficiary form to the children.
Yeah, I mean that was the real surprise to his kids, you can imagine. And so what happened was they went to court over this, and the federal district court in Baton Rouge decided that 100% of the IRA goes to her, the new wife, and disinherited the kids.
Wow.
I mean, the lawyer was furious in that case. He said it's a trap, an absolute trap for people like Mr. Kidder, who obviously was probably rolling over in the grave. How did this happen? It was supposed to go to my kids.
Right. He had no intention of disinheriting his
children.
Yeah,
but that's what happens to 401ks.
And why are they different?
Well, they're big questions that people need to ask. And if you don't ask the questions, it can hurt your entire life savings. But there are special rules, Deborah, that differ between 401ks and IRAs. Now, rule number one is with 401ks, your spouse is the presumed beneficiary of your account on your death, regardless of who you have said is the beneficiary, unless that spouse has previously signed off saying, I don't want it.
That's usually that spousal consent form that
That's right. Yes. That's the one that we use in our office all the time. If she has signed off on a spousal consent form saying, I don't want it, then it can go to the kids or whomever he wants. But if she doesn't, then it's going to go to the, that's the rules of 401ks. Now, IRAs are much more flexible, right?
Right. They really are. With an IRA, which is subject to state law, you generally can name anyone you like as the beneficiary with or without your spouse's consent.
That's right. That's the big difference between IRAs and 401ks. And they gave an example of a Wayne Wilson who got married in 2000. 2 years later, after retiring, he opens up an IRA. He names his four grown children from a prior marriage as beneficiaries. And 3 years after that, he died. And then his wife tried to claim that the IRA belonged to her because it came from his old 401k. Well, this went to court. And now it was a reverse decision. The court said, nope, it all goes to the children because spouses have no rights under IRA beneficiary rules. And so that's the big difference there. The court had to rule in both of those cases.
And I think you can see why a lot of people are often confused. Does my beneficiary form cover me or not?
Yeah.
Have I asked the right questions? Have I filled it out? Have I updated it? And what are the rules that my employer are going to apply to those forms?
That's right.
So what if you designate your spouse as the IRA beneficiary and later get divorced?
Well, if you go ahead and become divorced later on and you have an IRA, then your assets, your retirement assets in your IRA will pass according to the default plan that's laid out in the IRA document. And typically that means it's going to bounce back to your estate and follow what it says in the will. Typically, your estate is going to go that way, especially if you're single.
Okay. And single, of course, can mean divorced.
That's right.
You know, divorced again.
That's right.
Or single again. Well, workers generally don't need a spouse's consent to cash out of a 401k or roll it to an IRA when they change jobs or retire.
You know, that is another one of these loopholes that people scream about, but that's exactly true. Employers may impose such a rule, but the vast majority of employers don't, and there's no federal law requiring employers to do it. So what it means is that when you change jobs or you retire, there's nothing to prevent you from simply just rolling it over to an IRA and leaving it to the gardener or the golf pro.
Or your adult children.
You
know, which is where we began.
And, right.
And if you do have questions about your IRA, your 401k, your beneficiaries, please give us a call on the open lines, 860-WPTF. That's 860-9783. Or 800-662-7979.
You can get more information on Doug and Linda's website at lfmadvisor.com. That's lfmadvisor.com.
Thank you for joining us on Money Matters with Doug Lewis. And Doug, it looks like we've got a caller.
Bobby, how can I help you this evening?
Hi, Doug and Linda. How are you this evening?
Fine.
Oh,
how are
just
you?
Fine. Thanks for calling.
In forming a C corporation between two individuals, where each owns 50% of the stock. The consideration is whether in having a cross-purchase agreement for each of us to hold an insurance policy on the other partner to fund the purchase of that, or to hold an insurance policy on ourselves and either will or gift our half of the corporation to the other in the event of our death. The idea is that in the event I die,
right,
my wife does not want any of the stock. She does not want anything to do with the company.
Sure. That's standard in small businesses.
Exactly. We're just trying to figure out the best way to handle the transfer of the stock.
I like the stock redemption method, tell you the truth, best, which is not one of the two choices you met.
Explain that briefly to me.
Well, the question is, who gets the insurance proceeds?
Right.
The fallacy and the one that you laid out as choice number two is that she writes it in her will that she's going to do something with the stock. Well, how does your partner know when she changes her will? Or how do you know when your partner changes his will? You wouldn't know that. So there's no control.
Right.
Let's put it the other way. Your partner dies and his wife gets stock in the company. Now, you got to go ahead and deal with her in running this company, and you don't want to deal with her, and she doesn't know how to, and so, but she's got these stock certificates.
Okay.
All right. So the way I prefer to see it is where the company buys life insurance on the two of you for the value of the stock.
Okay.
Now, if your partner dies, then the beneficiary of the policy is the corporation. And there is a buy-sell agreement that says the corporation must use that money to purchase the stock from your partner's widow, which means that the proceeds come back to the corporation. The corporation then turns around and gives them to her. She gives the corporation back its certificates, and you're the sole remaining shareholder.
Does that change the value of the company in any way? Are there any tax consequences there?
Well, there are some pros and cons tax-wise in both the cross-purchase and the stock redemption method. And I would have to go out and I'd have to go ahead and spend some time with you laying out the pros and cons of each.
Mm-hmm.
But I generally like the method of a stock redemption because you can use it all as as a deductible expense to the corporation.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And yes, it will go ahead and increase the value, of the corporation, but I don't think that's a major issue here. I think I generally prefer that one, but I think that's probably as far as I should go on the air with this one because I need to get a lot more facts in front of me before I go any further. But I think the stock redemption versus the cross purchase makes a little, and you can usually get the insurance cheaper.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And by the way, how old are you guys?
36.
You might want to go ahead and get a level term policies, which are dirt cheap.
Well, that's what we have, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, level term policies, for the next 10, well, you could get 20-year level term policies on for something like this, and eventually you'll be able to go ahead and self-fund the buy-sell.
Right. Not being familiar with the stock redemption scenario that you've thrown out here, I'm going to mull that over a little bit. I may want to give you a call and come out and speak with you about it.
Sure, welcome to.
That number in Raleigh is 919-872-7000. That's 919-USA-7000.
Okay.
Thank you for calling, Bobby.
Thanks, Doug. Thanks.
All right.
Richard.
Bye-bye now. Hi, Richard. This is Doug Lewis, Linda Lewis, Deborah Lewis. How can we help you this evening?
Yes, sir. I had a question. My wife's retiring next year. She has three retirement policies. One we borrowed off of this year to build a bathroom up back to the house.
I'm sorry. You say you have three retirement plans?
She does.
Uh-huh.
My wife does. She works for the federal government, so she has three retirement programs.
Yep.
Okay? One we borrowed off of, because you borrow off of, we borrowed $50,000 off that to do a room addition off the back of the house. But she is wanting to retire next year, and we're wondering, she's going to get another $125,000. We only owe like $70,000 on the house. She debating whether do we pay the house off, we have no more bills from retirement, or do we keep paying the house payments and invest the rest of the money, and we're at 4.5% interest on the house.
Let me ask you a couple of questions.
Okay,
first of all, how old are you, Richard?
I'm 57, she's 59.
57 and 59.
She retires 30 years.
All right. Now, you say she has three retirement plans. What are the other two? How much? Not what are they, but how much are they?
Both of them were $100,000 apiece.
All right.
And then her regular retirement from the federal government.
Okay. So she has $100,000 coming from two of them, and the third one is $125,000, but she's borrowed $60,000 already.
Both of them were $100,000. She's already borrowed $50,000 off the one.
Well, wait a minute.
And in her regular retirement, what you get. So.
All right, I'm a little confused. First of all, you should never borrow any money from a retirement plan, but that's already been done. But I'm trying to see. I'm sorry?
We've already done it twice.
Right, right, right. You can't go back and fix that. But what you can say is, because what you've borrowed, you still owe that money.
Correct.
So when you go ahead, when she leaves her retirement, she wants to roll this money from all three into an IRA. That's the first thing. She wants to roll all three into one IRA account, and that's a tax-free move. But to roll them over, the loans have to be paid off. So on the first one, you're saying there's a $60,000 loan. Is it still $60,000 that's owed?
Yes, we just borrowed it a couple of months ago.
All right, so that means, and it's worth $125,000, you said, right?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
All right, that means that when she rolls that over, they're going to take that loan away, pay it back, and that means she'll get $65,000 on that one, correct?
Yeah, we already knew we were going to pay penalties on that one.
No, you won't pay any penalties. No, you're getting yourself confused, Richard. Stay with me one step at a time.
Okay.
All right. On the first one that you owe $60,000 on, you really have a $65,000 that she owns because she owes $60,000 and it's worth $125,000. So if she rolls that $65,000 into an IRA, that's step one. Now, step two is the other two. They're worth $100,000, or do they have any loans against them?
No, there's only one more, $100,000.
Oh, I thought you said there were three. Oh, okay, so there's not three of them. There's only one more.
Right, one more, and then that's a regular retirement after that.
All right, and that one is going to, that's $100,000. All right, so that one should roll into an IRA also. Now she has $165,000 in an IRA. Now, before I answer your question about what to do with that $165,000, pay off the mortgage or not, tell me what other investments you've got.
Nothing.
Nothing. Nothing. So she's worked 30 years, and are you still employed?
I'm employed, but I'm a construction worker, and I don't have nothing.
Okay. All right, so it sounds like that y'all don't have a lot of accumulation. And that means that you should definitely not go ahead. Now, the house, you say you're selling the house?
No, we want to move in 2 years after she retires.
All right.
She'll retire.
Okay, well, number one, you do not want to pay off that mortgage.
Okay.
Because to get the money out, to pay the mortgage, you're going to lose almost half of it. So if you take out, if you take that, all right, let's say you step one, you roll the whole thing into an IRA, and step two, you roll the other one in. Now you got $165,000 in an IRA, and you can invest it any way you want. But if you take out $60,000 or $70,000 to pay off the mortgage, you're only going to get about $40,000 because the taxes you'll pay on it. So
all
that
right, that. I didn't know what we're getting investment on IRA compared to interest.
Oh, you can get any once. That's the beauty of moving it into an IRA. An IRA is not an investment. An IRA is an account. The A stands for account, and the I is individual, and the R is retirement. Now it's an individual retirement account, and you can invest that money in any investments you want inside the IRA because it's her account. She's not limited to certain choices. So let's say that she meets with a certified financial planner like myself, and she develops a little investment portfolio of different mutual funds inside this IRA. Well, she doesn't pay any tax on that.
Until we pull it out.
Well, but my view is she should never pull it out.
Right, we're trying to set accounts to the grandchildren out of her retirement. We're setting up that too. Yeah.
Well, I think that you really need to focus on yourselves first. And
yes.
if you have only accumulated the $165,000, then I would go ahead and invest that. Get it structured with the help of a certified financial planner. Get it invested properly, and then go and do cash flow planning on what y'all are going to live on as you move into this next stage of your lives, especially since you don't have predictable income.
No, I don't. Yeah, Bob. Got some inheritance coming, but that's 2 years down the road.
Yeah, you never wait for somebody to die to go ahead and... Correct. Yeah, that doesn't work. So, really, I would protect what's still there. I would not go ahead and use it. I would invest it cautiously in an IRA account with maybe three or four or five mutual funds and then proceed from there. That's what I would do. What are y'all going to live on after she retires?
It's her money. That's what I can do. Yeah.
So y'all are gonna live on what you're able to earn.
Yes.
Okay.
I do craft work all this, but anyway, yeah, I can make a decent living.
Okay. Well, as long as you're comfortable that you're able to generate enough cash flow to support y'all's needs, then definitely do it this way. Don't deplete the little bit that she has left by trying to pay off a mortgage. That doesn't achieve anything.
She was trying to tell me that, and I'm arguing with her. Leave it the way it is. We get tax deductions because insurance, the house, everything, the boys, we get tax deductions off this. Yeah.
Yeah. But I would not leave it in the government retirement plan. I would roll it into an IRA.
Okay.
I would definitely not leave it where it is.
Yeah, the government's not doing real good.
That's right. That's right. No, you want to take control. She can take control by doing it into a tax-free IRA rollover.
Okay.
All right. And if I can help you any more, call me at the office. My office number is 872-7000. That's 872-7000.
Okay.
Hope that helps a little bit, Richard.
Yes, sir, it does. I can tell her what to do because she wanted to pay it off. I told her, no, please don't. Yeah. Arguing back and forth.
Yeah. No.
You like me a little bit.
No, there are a lot of homeless people that don't have any mortgages. Don't worry. You know, being mortgage free is not the goal.
But she just don't want to have any payments. We don't, when we are sitting in retirement, she don't want to pay.
Yeah. No. Wait until the house is sold. When you sell the house, that's when the mortgage goes away.
Yeah. But $700 a month around here is cheap. You know, that's a,
yeah.
Under.
Well, I hope that helps, Richard. Call me if I can give you any more information.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Well, did you see the article about REITs this week?
You know, Deborah, it was really a very good article. Of course, the article is entitled in the Wall Street Journal, REITs Don't Fail Me Now. But, you know, with mortgage rates being at historic lows, housing prices being a disaster, still for investors, many of them eyeing these REITs, these real estate income trusts, has been a very, very good type of investment. Now, these real estate investment trusts can buy property like apartment buildings, office parks, and they don't pay taxes on their income as long as they pay out the majority of it to the shareholders as dividends. That's what makes their cash flow so high.
And that's the magic behind the REIT. it's a Goldilocks situation with low interest rates, but also strong demand and tight supply. And we've noticed a correction, and now prices are really attractive.
That's what a number of the REIT mutual fund managers are saying, that it is a wonderful time. Now, there's one way for investors to compare different REITs, because different REITs differ from each other. And the way you compare them is the lease periods, the periods of the leases of the kinds of real estate that the real estate investment trust, the REIT, owns. For example, if leases are short, then cash flow changes more quickly in response to economic conditions. And when leases are long, then the investment income is nice and steady. Of course, that's going to put hotel REITs at one extreme because they're leases.
Right, a room booking.
They're room booking, so that's a one-day lease.
Right.
And at the other end of the spectrum, You know, you've got things like
healthcare facilities.
Healthcare facilities.
Where people stay for long, you know, 10, 15 years.
Those leases, that's right.
Right.
They can be as long as 15 years. Right. And so their income is going to be nice and steady. Right. Then you, in between, you have multifamily. That's apartment leases. That's usually one-year leases.
Yeah.
You've got industrial warehouse REITs. They have 3 to 5 year leases. Shopping centers, shopping malls, they've got 7 to 10 years. And then there's the high-quality suburban office properties. There's all kinds of REITs out there.
And because they're made up of so many different kinds of types of properties, you have these different lengths of leases.
Yeah. And some of them are paying very nice dividends. The article cited a diversified property REIT, which was paying 6.5% interest. There was another one that was focused on multifamily housing, that's apartments, and they had a very nice dividend yield.
How about healthcare REITs?
Oh, they are very good. There's nice opportunities out there with the healthcare REITs. I do like them as a class because I'm not concerned at all about Medicare or the Health Care Act and so forth. It's simply going to go ahead and put work well for medical office buildings and hospitals, all of which are in the healthcare REITs.
How about the REIT buyers? What do they need to really pay attention to if you're going to be interested in investing in the REIT world?
I would say the most important thing is to, when you look for REITs, check the leverage.
What do you mean by leverage?
The amount of mortgage, the amount of debt that's on the REIT itself.
I see.
In other words, you can have most real estate investors use debt to increase their returns. That gets a higher interest rate back. I mean, that gets a higher dividend back to the investors. And, of course, the interest rates are so low right now, it works nice. But you should be careful. Conservative REIT buyers might want to make sure that their REITs have 65% or less in debt. And most of the ones in this article said that their debt was only 40-50%, something like that. So, yeah, those are the things to watch out for. But the REITs themselves, very attractive for cash flow.
And another aspect of what's going on in the housing industry at large, whether it's commercial or residential.
Yeah.
And how it's all affecting all of us in all the different areas.
It's the way that you can take advantage of what's happening right now.
As an investor.
Yeah, there's a lot of good investment news that's out there right now.
Yeah, there really is. Well, there was, a few more minutes left. There was another little article about how consumers can protect themselves. There's a consumer guide to financial self-defense that the Certified Financial Planner Board of Standards has put out, and it discusses 10 red flags that should alert investors to possible fraud and other self-defense moves for each.
Yeah, because in a time and a period like we're in now, there's a lot of too good to be true scams out there.
There really are.
And I really appreciate the Consumer's Guide to Financial Self-Defense published by the Certified Financial Planner Board of Standards. They have the 10 red flags that should alert investors to when you may be running into a scam. Any PA clients or listeners are welcome to call my office. We do have access to that Consumer's Guide to Financial Self-Defense. You have to always realize that if it sounds too good to be true, it generally is.
It really is. Well, there was one last thing I wanted to ask you about. Some high-yield bond funds have lost far more than others in the recent slide.
You know, the junk bond area has been very attractive up until the last month or so. And the mutual funds that have the high-yield bonds in them had a 12-month return of 12% right up until the end of July. So a 12-month return for 12% return for 12 months, that was very attractive. And then all of a sudden, there was about a 3 or 4% drop in the month of August. But nevertheless, some of the high-yield bond funds are very conservative. They hold plain vanilla junk bonds. And I think they will do fine. I really do. Just have to watch out what kind of bond fund that you're in. And don't do it yourself. Do it with the help of a professional because you could be easily deceived.
Thank you. been listening to Money Matters with Doug and Linda Lewis. Money Matters provides you with a personal financial hotline on any subject where money really matters. For more information, you can call Doug and Linda in Raleigh at 872-7000. That's USA 7000. Listen again next Sunday at 6:05 for Money Matters with Doug and Linda Lewis on 680 WPTF.